Good evening. The Trump peace plan enrages Palestinians. Is it a win for Netanyahu? An earthquake hits near Cuba and Jamaica, and the Police Benevolent Association sues to overturn a voter referendum. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Tuesday, January 28th, 2020. Donald Trump proposed creating a Palestinian state as part of a Middle East peace plan today. The plan drew Palestinian condemnation. It's said to be a retread of the 2003 George W. Bush plan that was rejected by Palestinians already. The Trump version will let Israel maintain control of long-contested West Bank settlements and the Jordan River Valley. Trump announced his plan for Israeli-Palestinian peace at a White House event with embattled Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu standing at his side. It includes what Trump called a four-year freeze by Israel on new settlement activity.
This map will more than double the Palestinian territory and provide a Palestinian capital in eastern Jerusalem where America will proudly open an embassy. To ensure that the status quo of the Temple Mount is preserved and strong measures are taken to ensure that all Muslims who wish to visit peacefully and pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque will be able to do so. This is a major statement. This is of major importance. And at the same time, our vision will deliver massive commercial investment of $50 billion into the new Palestinian state. You have many, many countries that want to partake in this. This includes adopting basic laws enshrining human rights, protecting against financial and political corruption, stopping the malign activities of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other enemies of peace, ending the incitement of hatred against Israel, so important, and permanently halting the financial compensation to terrorists. Jerusalem is a safe, open, democratic city that welcomes people of all faiths and all places. It is time for the Muslim world to fix the mistake it made in 1948 when it chose to attack instead of recognize the new state of Israel. It's time.
But you, Mr. President, you recognize that Israel must have sovereignty in the Jordan Valley and other strategic areas of Judea and Samaria. Rather than pay easy lip service to Israel's security and simply shut your eyes, hope for the best. You recognize that Israel must have sovereignty in places that enable Israel to defend itself by itself. For too long, far too long, the very heart of the land of Israel, where our patriarchs prayed, our prophets preached, and our kings ruled, has been outrageously branded as illegally occupied territory. Well, today, Mr. President, you are puncturing this big lie. You are recognizing Israel's sovereignty over all the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria, large and small alike. Regardless of the Palestinian decision, Israel will preserve the path of peace in the coming years. For at least 4 years, Israel will maintain the status quo in areas that your plan does not designate as being part of Israel in the future. At the same time, Israel will apply its laws to the Jordan Valley, to all the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria, and to other areas that your plan designates as part of Israel, in which the United States has agreed to recognize as part of Israel. And Jared Kushner, without your wisdom, your persistence, your resolve, this day would have never come.
Trump mispronounced the Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of the holiest places in Islam. It lies on the Temple Mount in central Jerusalem. During his speech, he acknowledged the presence of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, that is President Trump. He referenced an incident last week where Pompeo cursed out an NPR reporter demanding she find Ukraine on the map.
That reporter couldn't have done too good a job on you yesterday. Huh? I think you did a good job on her, actually. That's good. Thank you, Mike. Great. Very. Are you running for Senate? I guess the answer is no after that. Huh? They all want him to. Kansas, great state. They want him to. But you're doing a great job. Don't move.
Many pundits have said that Pompeo's antics with that reporter were designed to impress the president, who likes it when his spokespeople are tough and mean, actually, with media, members of the media. In an interview with Al Jazeera's Adhikaram Fukara, pardon me with that, the said architect of the plan, Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, had this to say.
These people, the Palestinians, have been lied to for so many years, right? And they've been promised things, and there's been no counter to the promises that have been made to them. So if they have certain expectations that are not realistic, I feel bad for them. They've been lied to by their leadership, and they've been lied to by a lot of people, and they've been used as pawns in the Middle East, okay? The fundamental question that you have to ask yourself, if you are an Arab or a Muslim throughout the world who cares about the Palestinians, is, do I want the Palestinians to have an opportunity to live a better life? Right. And if the answer is yes, then the leadership, what are they going to do? Do a day of rage? No, the leadership should sit at the table and say, this is what we need in a pragmatic way to try to make that happen. But one thing that this leadership has not been able to do over the years is they have not been able to make these deals. Now, sometimes they haven't had a great partner in Israel, but President Trump has earned the trust in the Muslim world, and he's also earned the trust in Israel. And he has delivered for them now an opportunity of historic proportions where they have a pathway to a state. And they have a map, and they could have a capital in East Jerusalem, and that's an amazing thing. And then in terms of the interests of Muslims throughout the world, the number one fear that I heard about, because I spoke with a lot of people over the last couple of years to put this together, is that Muslims fear the mosque being under attack, the mosque not being respected, and Israel's agreed that we are fully going to respect the mosque. The mosque is totally safe, and that any Muslim from throughout the world who wants to come and visit the mosque to pray peacefully is now welcome. That is a major breakthrough. The conflict between Israel and the Muslim world should be resolved based on that. And so what we've delivered now for the Palestinian leadership is the most real opportunity that they have ever had to achieve statehood, to improve the lives of the Palestinian people. And one other thing I'll say is that when Arafat was thinking of making a deal, one of his biggest fears, and this is what's been reported, is that his fear was that the Arab world would say that he was a traitor to the cause. Today, you have a full different situation. The entire Arab world is begging for the Palestinians to resolve this.
Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law, who was in charge of putting together this peace plan. Pointedly, there were no questions allowed from the media at the end of the press conference, as usually occurs. And Palestinian activist and professor Ramzi Baroud, who's the author of a book of Palestinian prisoners' stories, says he wasn't surprised by the plan and that Palestinians have rejected it. And the United Nations, he added, has told Israel all relevant UN measures concerning Palestinian rights of return to Israel remain in force.
U.S. foreign policy didn't really change. What really changed is that Trump kind of really removed the mask completely. Now we see U.S. foreign policy the way it has always been. So in my opinion, there hasn't really been a fundamental change. There has been Trump just basically exposed the country's foreign policy. And in the most shameful and disgraceful way, I mean, the fact that the U.S. is now defying international law so openly, not just by legalizing the internationally recognized illegal colonies and settlements in the West Bank and Jerusalem, but the status of Jerusalem itself, the status of Palestinian refugees who have the right to go home to their homeland and so forth. Now the U.S. is openly advocating the exact opposite of all of these things. Who is going to take the U.S. serious anymore as far as respecting international law and all other treaties, not just regarding Palestine or the climate change or whatever, but in any other way? To barter your country's reputation and leadership in exchange for, you know, some little political capital in Israel is wrong, and it's a huge mistake from any point of view. But as far as Palestinians are concerned, we really have nothing to be shocked about. Without U.S. support of Israel, the $3.8 billion of U.S. aid to Israel would have never been able to maintain its occupation of Palestine throughout all these years. For us, little has changed aside from the fact that now we can tell the pro-Washington elites in our midst, see, you have been chasing this mirage for so many years, and we told you it's wrong. We told you to cease and desist. unify your people, resist using popular forms of resistance. This is the proper approach. And you didn't listen to us. And look, you got absolutely nothing at the end of the day.
Was there anything the U.S. could have ever done? Did the U.S. ever, was it ever perceived as other than just a supporter of the occupying power to Palestinians? I mean, was there ever a chance?
Excellent question. I think at one point, I would say in the early 1990s, there was an actual debate in Palestine that maybe the U.S. has changed its ways, and maybe if we find some kind of a compromise, the U.S. is ready to perhaps offer us something that we can live with. I and among many other Palestinian intellectuals, of course, we doubted this because, you know, the foreign policy doesn't just change overnight. But there was indeed a degree of credibility for the United States among certain, you know, sections of Palestine's political elite. And that lasted for several years until the second Palestinian Intifada in 2002 came to say that no one believes in that anymore. And the U.S. has been, completely marginalized as far as its credibility is concerned.
What happens next? What happens next?
What really happens next is something that for Palestinians at this point to seek alternatives. Now, the United Nations declared today, the Secretary of the UN declared that nothing changes as far as UN resolutions pertaining to Palestine and the illegality of the Israeli occupation and the two-state solution. So now there is a complete split between U.S. foreign policy that was predicated on respecting international law and on the United Nations. You have that. That's a major issue, and I think that's going to have lots of repercussions in the future. But also in the Palestinian side, the Arabs are now divided. You had some Arab officials today in Washington celebrating this historic opportunity. There will be a split within the region itself between those who are willing to play ball and are willing to accommodate U.S. whims and Israeli whims in the region, and those who refuse that. So we are going to see a split happening in the region as well. What will this do to the Palestinian body politic? Will Palestinians finally unify their rank and speak as one political unit, or continue to play this factional game that really cost us so much and gave Israel so much political space and room to maneuver until we reach this sinister moment of the deal of the century?
Palestinian activist and professor Ramzi Baroud. He's the author of a book of Palestinian prisoners' stories. One of the demands Trump makes in his plan is the disarmament of Hamas, the elected government of Gaza. An attorney for Hamas is Stanley Cohen. He expressed his disdain for the plan.
I represented Hamas for 20 years.
In that light, what about these countries, United Arab Emirates,
They're
Bahrain?
Useless.
They all
useless.
Were there.
The Gulf is useless. The Gulf is irrelevant. The Gulf has nothing to do with it. The Gulf is supporting genocide in Yemen. The Gulf is complicit. The Palestinians have not relied upon anybody from the Gulf except for Kuwait, except for Qatar that has played an important role for a long time. And I would be surprised if there was an ambassador from Qatar in D.C. today at the meeting. Qatar is the only country in the Gulf. Kuwait at times has stood strong, but in terms of Bahrain, UAE, in terms of Saudi Arabia, forget that. So.
They said this was a real estate deal.
Yeah, of course it is. We're going to extend your lease for a certain amount of time. You're going to pay interest on it. You're going to trickle down some money. It's going to Stuytown 30 years ago and offering people in buildings a $25,000 lump sum check to leave.
And that's Stanley Cohen, who is the former attorney for Hamas. As he said, several of the Gulf states were there to support the plan, including the United Arab Emirates, which shares a close relationship with Jared Kushner. And finally, a powerful magnitude 7.7 earthquake struck in the Caribbean Sea between Jamaica and eastern Cuba on Tuesday, shaking a vast area from Mexico to Florida and beyond, but there were no reports of casualties or heavy damage. Ryan Gould is with the United States Geological Survey.
2:10 local time, there was a magnitude 7.7 earthquake which occurred off the coasts of Cuba and Jamaica. It was located, I think, about a little over 100 kilometers northwest of Jamaica and similar distance west of the southwest tip of Cuba.
And was that in a populated areas affected by that at all?
So the earthquake occurred offshore, and it was over 100 kilometers from the coastline. So fortunately, it didn't occur directly adjacent to high population areas.
Now, I know you don't talk about tsunamis, but there was a tsunami warning of sorts that went out there. Is this the type of earthquake that might cause a tsunami?
That's a great question. So the preliminary estimate is that this was a strike slip faulting event, and we don't typically expect significant tsunamis from strike slip faulting events. Of course, there are caveats to that, exceptions. But it's usually thrust faulting events that produce sort of catastrophic tsunamis.
And does this earthquake have anything to do or is connected in any way to the one that struck Puerto Rico?
The short answer is that both Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico and this earthquake are located along a plate boundary. That is the plate boundary that separates the Caribbean plate from North America. So they're related in terms of their tectonic setting, although they are located significant distances apart.
Is there anything here that could be predictive of a larger earthquake or something out of a disaster movie? The beginning warnings of that?
This earthquake occurred on a plate boundary, much like the San Andreas. So it's an area where we expect or anticipate major earthquakes of this type. And this is certainly within the realm of sort of the magnitude that would be typically expected. The follow-up to that is that, we certainly expect aftershocks to follow this earthquake.
And do you think any of them be closer to the land? Any aftershocks could threaten the islands?
Typically, aftershocks are located in the area where the epicenter occurred. In this case, because it was such a large magnitude earthquake, we expect that it broke a fault, and likely a good portion of it was underwater, if not all of it, and it could have extended, a rupture could have extended over lengths as much as 170 kilometers. That's kind of the typical length that we would expect for an earthquake of this magnitude. So we'd expect aftershocks to be located in that area of the fault that broke in this earthquake.
And that's Ryan Gould of the United States Geological Survey. The Pacific Tsunami Warning Center initially warned that the quake could generate waves of 1 to 3 feet above normal in Cuba, Jamaica, and the Cayman Islands, Honduras, Mexico, and Belize, but issued a later message saying the danger had passed. And now, finally, Communities United for Police Reform sent out a press release today responding to the PBA, the Police Benevolent Association's lawsuit, which was aimed against the changes that had been made in the Civilian Complaint Review Board charter amendments that was passed in the election last year. CD's main police union is attempting to undermine democracy and subvert the will of New Yorkers by suing to overturn a police accountability voted for this past fall. In the lead up to the November election, police unions spent over $127,000 in just 5 days to defeat this measure and protect cops' rights to lie. That's their words. Without consequence and police unions' massive injection of cash and baseless fear-mongering, again their words, New Yorkers voted for police accountability. This latest PBA attempt to gut democratic processes with legal maneuvers and lies should be understood as a dangerous play to protect officers who lie and cover up violence, and it should be rejected and criticized by the court and all New Yorkers. That's from Communities United for Police Reform and their response to the Police Benevolent Association lawsuit. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, January 28th, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.